reported. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. And welcome to this Monday edition of A Public Affair. This is your host, John Quinlan. Again, here on A Public Affair. Sometimes Mondays are a little slow in getting started, especially a rainy day like today. But we're glad to have you with us on what should be a very special hour. Have the opportunity today to Mikko Peled on the phone from down in Atlanta. He's on a national book tour talking about a fascinating new work called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And it's just a very interesting life's journey, a tale of reconciliation, a tale of peace, something I think that will appeal to you on many different levels. And, of course, it's also about a very controversial subject, one that sometimes folks are reluctant to come to common ground on. But Mikko's story, I think, is one that lends great credibility as he talks about his family and his own journey. Mikko, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Hi, Mikko. Thanks so much for joining us. And we just want to mention at the outset that you are going to be appearing here in Madison. And I wanted to actually start out, for various reasons, I wanted to dedicate this show to the memory of Senator George McGovern, who is someone who actually had some very strong feelings about peace in the Middle East. But one of the things I discovered about Senator McGovern over the weekend was a remarkable story that he told of reconciliation back in the early 90s on the occasion of the funeral of First Lady Pat Nixon. He was one of two Democrats who decided to attend. And he talks about reasons for doing that in terms of his personal admiration for her and her integrity and authenticity, but also talks about the importance of doing things like that in the name of reconciliation. Here he was going to the funeral of the wife of someone who was his bitter political opponent, who, you know, had pulled all these dirty tricks back in 1972. Of course, it all came out in the course of Watergate. And yet he did so without bitterness and with a sense of, you know, trying to make peace. You know, it strikes me that reconciliation is also this theme that weaves its way through your book. And I guess we're backing into this a little bit, but could you talk about why that's a value that you hold and that your family holds?
Well, you know, reconciliation is all we've got. I mean, what are we going to do if we don't reconcile with people that we disagree, live in bitterness forever? I mean, that's no way to live. It's painful. It's not healthy, and it doesn't do anybody any good, whereas reconciliation opens up possibilities that you had no idea even existed. And so there's no question that reconciliation is the way to do things, is the way to go about dealing with your people who seemingly are on the other side.
Could you tell us a little bit about your father? Please help me with pronunciations as we go along. His name was, is it pronounced Mati?
Yeah, Mati Peled.
Peled. And he was someone who was involved in the Israeli War for Independence. Also, someone very prominent in the 1967 war when he became a general, or was a general at the time, rather. So someone much admired by the Israeli people, and yet later he chose a path of becoming
of
a
reconciliation.
Peacemaker. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
How did he get there?
Well, you know, his path was very interesting, and it's a question that I get asked a lot, especially by people who are familiar with his career. He was, you know, as a young man, he volunteered to the Jewish militia, the Haganah, or the Zionist militia, I should say, with fully believing that in the ideal of fighting for a state for the Jewish people. And he did that. He was part of the Haganah. You know, as in high school, he did all this training in 1947, 48. He was part of the war. And this was really the militia that conducted the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians in 1948. He was an officer. He remained in the army when the militia became the army, and you know, Palestine became Israel. He was an officer. In 1956, Israel, Britain, and France attacked Egypt, and Israel conquered the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip, and he became the military commander, the military governor of Gaza. And that was really his first encounter with Palestinians, and that was probably the first the first step in his transformation, where he realized, suddenly, first of all, he realized that he was this overlord, this governor, this occupier, you know, which is something he didn't like. You know, as a young man, he fought, you know, the Haganah, the Jewish militia, was supposed to fight the British, who were the occupiers of the country then in 47, 48. So he didn't like that role, and he also was very frustrated that he couldn't speak to the people. He didn't speak Arabic. Of course, Palestinians speak Arabic, and he took the time to study Arabic, he took the time to speak with the leadership, and he realized the Palestinians had no desire to destroy Israel or to kill Jews. They wanted reconciliation. That episode ended up very quickly. In those days, when the United States told a small country to do something, they did it, and the United States told Israel to give back Egypt and to give Egypt back the Sinai and the Gaza Strip, and they did very quickly. And then 10 years later, there was a Six-Day War. By then, he was a general. He'd been a general for some time. And he and the other generals were the young commanders of the 1948 war that created Israel. So now, here they were. They were the generals. And once again, it seemed like war was on the horizon. And the story that we hear about this and the story that they perpetuated was that Israel was under an existential threat, and therefore the army must attack quickly and must engage in a preemptive strike. And this is a story that kind of prevails to this day. But what's interesting is that when I went to the Army archives, as I was working on the book and I was looking at the minutes of the meetings of the generals leading up to that war of 1967, when they talk among themselves and when they talk between themselves and the cabinet ministers, they say a different thing altogether. They say that the Arab armies, particularly the Egyptian army, which is really the largest and the only army of any consequence at the time, was actually not prepared for war, and we had there was an opportunity to destroy them once again, and therefore they were pushing for a preemptive strike. So there's no talk at all about any kind of a danger, any kind of a threat, certainly not an existential threat. Then once the war was over in 6 days, Israel captured the Sinai again, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights in 6 days, and you have to wonder, you know, a country that's being attacked from the outside, how they do all that. Well, they weren't attacked from the outside. They initiated the attack. They initiated the war, and in 6 days, they destroyed two Arab armies, killed over 15,000 soldiers. I mean, it was a big operation, but it was obviously that it was not the challenge was not a big challenge for the Israeli army. But then, once the war was over, my father stood up and he said, "Okay, now we've conquered all of the land of Israel, all of Palestine. Now we have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian problem, because the Palestinians are still here and we're still here, and really we share the nation, we share this land with these other people. If we don't allow them to create a state within that country, within the land that we share, then we will be occupiers once again. If we remain as occupiers, they will start a resistance. The resistance will force us to become a brutal occupation army. It'll destroy the moral fiber of the nation and the moral fiber of the army." And he kept saying this from that day until he died, you know, in 1994. So that was his thing from that point on, and he became an advocate for Palestinian rights, both outside of the State of Israel and for Palestinian citizens within the State of Israel. But sadly, the rest of the country went a different way. As soon as that war was over, Israel expanded, built towns and cities for Israeli Jews only, expelled hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, took their land, destroyed homes, and this is something that they're doing to this day.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, that was kind of the point where he and the rest of the country kind of parted ways.
Well, we want to talk about going back to that history of the Nakba and how that was experienced in different ways. Just to punctuate what you were just saying about your dad, you quote him at that time as the 67 war was ending, of saying, "For the first time in Israel's history, we are face to face with the Palestinians. Without other Arab countries dividing us, now we have a chance to offer the Palestinians a state of their own." So clearly something he believed in very strongly. You have another parent, of course, who also has lived a life that's very consistent with that standard of reconciliation. And it's very interesting that in the time following the War of Independence, what Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, or the catastrophe, that at a time when many Israelis were moving into Palestinian homes that were no longer occupied. And of course, depending on which side of history you sit, those were either folks who left of their own volition or who were forced out. We can get into that in a second. But essentially, your mother decided that wasn't an option that was right for her. She had the chance to move into a beautiful, opulent home, furnished, and she made another choice. What drove her to that?
Yes, you know, it's interesting when people make the right choice and we admire them, as opposed to assuming that that's how everybody should behave. This is a conversation I've been having with several people as I give my lecture and I tell the story. So she was born and raised in Jerusalem, and she knew the neighborhood, the Palestinian neighborhoods, and the families that lived there. And just to make it clear, we're not talking about the old city of Jerusalem. We're talking about the newer neighborhoods that were built in what's called West Jerusalem, kind of the modern side of the city. And these are beautiful homes, and she would recall how she would walk around on a Saturday afternoon and see the family sitting in the yard, and there'd always be a lemon tree. And these are beautiful homes, and they're still there. The neighborhoods and the homes are still there in Jerusalem. Well, later on, as she was an adult, she was 22 years old. It's 1948. She has two young children. She's living in a small apartment with her mother. Her husband is an officer fighting for the Zionist cause. And as these neighborhoods were, and the term that the Zionist militia were used was cleansed, as these neighborhoods were cleansed of their Palestinian population, these homes were made available to Israeli families, and she was offered one of these homes, and the reaction hasn't changed. I've heard this story so many times as I was growing up, and to this day, you can see the emotion as she reacts. She says, how could I possibly take the home of another mother? How can I possibly live in the house of another family who's forced to live in exile? And, of course, when you think about it, you'd expect more people, or you expect that this would be people's reaction. And also, to this day, when I speak, and there are Palestinians in the audience, there's always somebody who comes up to me and says, you know, my family had a home in one of these neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And she made a choice that was consistent with her values and made consistent with her values throughout her life.
Lucas, can we call up clip two? We're going to skip over that first one. I want to play for, as we just go into a little bit further discussion about the Nakba, an excerpt from a speech Ilan Pape, Israeli historian, made here in Madison this past November. And again, he talks about a lot of what you're bringing up now, Miko, again, kind of the contradictions that were inherent in some of the decisions made at that time of independence.
Palestine was chosen as the venue in which one could satisfy these two noble impulses, safety and national independence, if you want to. As you all probably know, the problem is that Palestine was not empty. What they felt is still with us today. And the basic idea was that people believed or wanted to believe that, A, once they chose Palestine, they chose an ancient homeland. So the basic concept was of returning to a homeland. Now, what do you do when you return to a homeland and someone else is in your home? The fact that you actually left home 2,000 years ago is forgotten in this kind of engagement. And what matters is that someone has illegally occupied your home. There is kind of a paradox, typical to colonialist movements, by the way. The Palestinians sometimes are not there, because it's very convenient to treat Palestine as terra nulla, an empty land, as did the settlers who came to Australia, treated the Aboriginals' presence there. But sometimes they are there, and then you have to demonize them in order to disregard their connection to the place. So they're either absent or they are usurpers or illegal occupants of your homeland.
So, Miko, your response to that, this is an ongoing debate, is it not, about sort of the notion of an empty land, the sort of the legitimacy of Israeli claim versus Palestinian claims? Historians like Ilan Pape mentioned his work based in going through David Ben-Gurion's diaries, have been able to build a case, but it's still a matter of debate, isn't it?
You know, it's a funny debate. I'll tell you why. Because, you know, the whole notion of, when we talk about this, especially particularly when we talk about this today, you know, the whole notion of this return, you know, that somehow because somebody who may or may not have been some kind of a distant ancestor of mine left or was expelled of a certain country 2,000 years ago, that I today have some kind of a right to that land is really pretty absurd. But let's put that aside for a moment, because somehow the world accepted it for all kinds of different reasons. today we talk about, when people talk about, if you compare that to the right of return of the Palestinians, which of course is one of the biggest issues in the conflict, people say, oh, no, no, Palestinians have to forget, you know, what was, you know, the past was the past. And we're talking about people who were driven away from their homes 65 years ago. Many of them are still alive. If they're not alive, their descendants still have the keys and the deeds to their homes. Often they can walk through a field where a city or a town was destroyed, and they can still identify their home and the mosque and the well and so on. Yet when we talk about the right of return of these people, suddenly they have to forget. You know, they have no right of return because it was such a long time ago. There's an absurd double standard here that is really almost unbelievable. You know, that on the one hand we've got this right of return which has been sanctified of a people who may or may not be connected to the ancient Hebrews, and on the other hand we have people who are still alive, who are thrown out of their homes. Many of the homes are still standing, yet their right to return is being questioned. But this is typical. It's like Ilan Pape was saying, this is typical. All this myth has to be created, and this whole attitude about the Palestinians are either non-existent, or if they're there, then they're the wrong people, and we have to get rid of them. But all this was built, all this was created in order to justify this absurd notion that people have a right to return to their ancestral homeland after 2,000 years, you know, and this connection is tenuous at best between, you know, the Jews today, the Israelis today, and the ancient Hebrews. But there you have it. I mean, there's so much mythology has been built around this, and I don't know if you heard or, you know, when Netanyahu gave his speech at the General Assembly at the United Nations, he opened with this, with a connection to King David.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no historical proof that King David ever existed. So, I mean, this, you know, it's a really absurd argument that somehow we have Israelis or Jews around the world have the right to Palestine because of something the Bible claims may or may not have happened.
And I'm speaking with Miko Peled. He is the author of The General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And I'm sorry, Miko, just so we get the pronunciation right, your mother and father, again, their names?
Mati and Zika Peled.
Okay, we had a caller who I think joined us late who wanted to get a clarification on that. Again, just to mention, you will be speaking here in Madison this Thursday, the 25th, at 7:30 p.m. I think I had that off by a half hour, but 7:30 over at the Pyle Center, 702 Langdon Street. And for more information, you can write or go to the website of Rafa Sister City Project, rafasistercity@yahoo.com, or call 215-9157. And Lucas, actually, could we queue up clip three, please? Mentioning Bibi Netanyahu, there's an interesting family connection I'm going to want to bring in just a moment. I know your sister actually went to school with him, I believe. And I do want to actually, in our next segment, tell a bit of her story and, of course, the tragic story, the loss of your niece. But before we do that, this is actually a clip from almost 30 years ago, but I'm curious to hear your perceptions about how now Prime Minister Netanyahu's positions have changed in that time. This is a clip, a few things he had to say back in 1978.
Is the issue of self-determination the core of the conflict in the Middle East?
No, I don't believe it is. The real core of the conflict is the unfortunate Arab refusal to accept the state of Israel. And I think, as was mentioned earlier, for 20 years the Arabs had both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And if self-determination were, as they now say, the core of the conflict, they could have easily established a Palestinian state then, but they didn't.
When did the issue arise then?
Well, for 20 years, we didn't hear a word about self-determination. And in fact, what we did hear, those of us living in the Middle East, was about driving the Jews into the sea. Now, after 1967, under the leadership of the PLO, the hardline strategy shifted to adopting a moderate, dressed-up slogan, which now talked in terms of first a secular democratic state and then replaced it with Palestinian self-determination. But what this really means, contrary to what Mr. Arouri said, what the PLO Information Office said in a Dutch paper in 1977, in May 5th, the statement was very simple. Our objective remains the destruction of the Zionist state of Israel. So let's keep in mind that what we're talking about here is not the attempt to build a state, but to destroy one.
Miko Peled, your response is that still some of the same tune that's being sung today?
Yeah, Bibi hasn't. Yeah, Netanyahu hasn't changed his tune. He says the exact same things. I mean, you know, it's a combination of double standards, myths and lies that he and Zionists like him have been preaching from the very beginning. To say that there was no talk of self-determination for the Palestinians before 1967 is ridiculous. And to say that the Palestinians later on, when they did shift, the Palestinian platform did talk about a democratic state, one democratic state for Jews and Arabs in Palestine, which did mean to destroying the Zionist state, which meant removing Zionism, and just like apartheid was removed in South Africa because it's a racist idea. When half the population isn't Jewish and you want to force a Jewish state upon them, then that's not going to work. That's the same as apartheid. And the democratic state is, of course, a much better solution for everybody. But then later on, at the demand of Israel and the U.S. and others, and out of really a sense of pragmatism, Yasser Arafat, or led by Yasser Arafat, there was this movement within the PLO to change course and talk about what my father had talked about right after the 67 war, which is to create a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. Now, the Palestinians were completely willing to do this from the get-go. In fact, the dialogue between my father and Ohev Neri and several other prominent Israelis who became renegades because of this issue, and officials of the PLO began in 1974, I believe. But the Israeli government would have nothing to do with that. In fact, later on in the 80s, they outlawed those meetings. They passed a law specifically to outlaw these particular meetings between prominent Israelis and the PLO, because they did not want to engage in any kind of dialogue, any kind of negotiations with the Palestinians. And this only ended in 1993, and the reason it ended in 1993 is because by then they knew the West Bank could no longer become a Palestinian state because it was completely a part of the rest of Israel, with cities and towns built there for Israelis and so on. So Israel has tried all kinds of they've got the power to do this, and they've developed the mythology to do this, and they've developed a very good PR system, and I should say a brilliant PR machine, to perpetuate the story that somehow, number one, Jews have the right, number two, Palestinians either don't exist, don't have the right, or are out to kill us. But in any case, they always somehow manage to avoid the issue and not negotiate and not make any effort to make peace, because Zionism is not about peace. Zionism is a zero-sum game. It's about all the land for the Jewish people, period, and everybody else has to leave.
Yeah. You know, I want to draw a parallel here, and obviously, since we're in the middle of an election season, thinking about politics here, it seems to be just especially resonant. Actually, go back to the origins of Zionism, some of the justifications for it. I a couple of years ago, I had a chance to do a paper. It was on W.E.B. Du Bois, and he was someone actually who considered himself to be a Zionist, a prominent African American leader who was also very strong in his advocacy in terms of fighting anti-Semitism. Actually, the thesis of my paper is, had he lived to be not 95 as he did, but 155, that he probably would have come around on this issue and been closer to the Alice Walkers and some of the other folks in the African-American community, their position. But still, his argument is grounded in some of the resonance he felt in his own experience, that racial justice in his case was long in coming in America, and perhaps racial justice would never be achieved in America. So he looked to places like Liberia and other places where blacks might find a home because of the nature and the pervasiveness of the discrimination. Of course, when the Holocaust came, that changed the equation, and is, I'm sure, something that you have a profound appreciation for in terms of its effect on the Jewish people. There's a conundrum here, because there are exaggerations, distortions, manipulations, but all of it is rooted in something that was a truism, that the Jewish people were being persecuted no matter where they were, and perhaps this solution of a homeland was something that made sense.
Well, I don't completely accept the notion that Jews were persecuted wherever they were. Jews lived in the Arab world for thousands of years, and they were fine most of the time. Jews suffered under Christian rule. Christians, the persecution, the pogroms, the Holocaust, this was all done in Christian Europe. In the Arab world, by and large, Jewish people did very well. And there was a lot less persecution, and there was really the issues of Christian Europe do not apply to the Arab Jews. And I think that's an important point to make. And today there is a lot of manipulation. There's a lot of manipulation, and what they like to do, what Israel likes to do, is to blur the lines between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, between being against Israel and being against Jews. And most importantly, the difference between what it means to be Jewish and what it means to be a Zionist. You know, at least the first 50 years of its existence, most Jewish people thought the Zionists were lunatics and wouldn't have anything to do with them. Some out of ideology, because they realized it was a racist notion, an absurd notion, to come and create a Jewish state in an Arab country, which is what Palestine was. And others because they didn't think it was an important thing to do. And the Zionist movement, the Zionist leadership, they kind of proclaimed themselves as the saviors, as the leaders of the Jewish people, and later on they proclaimed Israel to be the state of the Jewish people, which is absolutely absurd because Jewish people live all around the world, and most Jews still live in other places. And so they complicated life for Jews. They complicated the issue of loyalty, of where people started questioning, well, if your country is over there, where do your loyalties sit? And that's kind of how the life of Arab Jews, the Jews in the Middle East, became unbearable because the Zionist state, the state of Israel, started meddling in their affairs. So it's true that the Holocaust was there's no question the Holocaust had a huge impact on the creation of the state of Israel, in the sense, especially in the West, that the West has wronged the Jews and therefore they must compensate them, and the compensation will be in the way of giving them a state in somebody else's country. But before that, far before the Holocaust, the buildup of the Zionist militia, for example, and the plan to ethnically cleanse Palestine came about before the Holocaust. And many of the people that put this together were Jews. It's true; these are Jews that came from Eastern Europe, and they already suffered from pogroms and racism against and anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe. And they thought that this would be the solution. But they by no means represent all of Jews. They by no means represent all Holocaust survivors. There are Holocaust survivors that won't set foot in Israel because it's a racist state, and they think that their claim is, as many other Jewish people, don't say that this is in our name. What you're doing there is inexcusable and unforgivable, and you're not don't say that you're doing this in our name. So it's very easy to manipulate this and to blur the lines between all the different realities. I mean, there is anti-Semitism, that's true, but anti-Zionism has got nothing to do with anti-Semitism because Zionism has got nothing to do with Judaism. You know, the Jewish state is, somebody said this, the Jewish state is has got nothing to do with Judaism, and there was a great Jewish thinker, Yeshayahu Leibovich, who lived in Jerusalem. He was an Orthodox Jew and a very outspoken man in terms of human rights and equal rights for the Palestinians. And he said that the Jewish state is as Jewish as the National Socialists were socialists. The two, they use the name, they use the word, but there's no connection between these two things.
All right. Hey, Lucas, could you queue up four, just a couple minutes yet? We're speaking with Mikko Peled. He is the author of The General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. This is your host on A Public Affair, John Quinlan, and I believe we have a caller on the line. Caller, your comment or question, please.
Yes. I just wanted to make an analogy. Listening to the commentator earlier, when the claim is made by Israel on this ancient ownership or possession of Israel, couldn't the same claim be made by the Native American population here in the United States that, given history, and in fact it's more current than the claim by Israel, the basis in history, and you even have a genocide basically thrown in there that makes the case even more like the one we have here. But at the same time, those that embrace Israel and its claims in this country would never even start the discussion of the Native American claim for this ancient right to reoccupy the lands that were taken from them. So I just find this so ironic, that and it's a good argument. I welcome your commentator today.
Thanks for your question. Mikko?
I think there's no question that Native Americans have a right to claim. They've got far more of a right to claim this country than Jewish people have a right to claim Palestine. That's for sure. I mean, the genocide, like you said, took place very recently. They're still here on the land, and there's no question that there's the parallel. But I would say the parallel is between the Native Americans and the Palestinians, not so much between the Native Americans and the Jews, because the Jews' connection to Palestine is really tenuous at best.
All right. If you have a question for Miko Peled, he's the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And we have another caller on the line. Your comment or question, please.
Yes. I wish you'd comment on two things. One, Norman Finkelstein has documented that it wasn't until after 1967 that the Holocaust became part of the myth of the so-called Jewish state. And second, Shlomo Sanz has written a book about the diaspora and shows that the word diaspora has become mythic in that so many of the so-called Jews were either forcibly dominated by other powers or converted under pressure, whatever, but that there is a large diaspora is mythic. Could you comment, please?
Well, he's the expert, and he's certainly written and has spoken quite a bit about this. It's true, you know. I haven't read the book, but I've heard him speak, and his claim is, and this is a claim that is much of it is really not that new, that the Jews in the diaspora, especially in areas where there were massive numbers of Jews, were a result of conversions, massive conversions that took place over the history, over the centuries, that nations converted to Judaism for all kinds of reasons, which of course means that these people have really no claim to the land of Israel because they're not the descendants of the Hebrews who were exiled by the Romans. And he makes a very good, very convincing point, I think.
All right, thank you, caller, for your question. I did want to come back a bit. The foreword to your book is written by Alice Walker, and I think, you know, obviously we shouldn't conflate all the different struggles here, but there are common resonances. And I know one of the things that she's written recently is that in some ways, in her experience traveling in the Gaza, the West Bank, she sees the Palestinian oppression as more brutal, or at least analogous to what she experienced in the Jim Crow South. I want to just bring in a little bit of an evocation about what life under the occupation is all about. On a personal note, I have a niece who, in 2008, as part of a college project, spent a semester working in the West Bank. And what she did was she was using dramatic techniques to achieve some level of catharsis or healing among children who had experienced trauma there. But she gave a speech a couple of years ago at our local Chautauqua called Finding Bob Fest. And this is what Sol had to say about some insights into life under occupation.
The occupation takes on a population, both the occupied and the occupiers. To understand occupation, we must not just look at the war crimes, but the slow, crushing, everyday violences. A slow deactivation through the technologies of occupation, of structured containment, mass arrest, curfew, colonization through the appropriation of land, resources, settlement construction. Every child and adult I worked with throughout the West Bank is in essence bleeding internally, suffering from psychological and physical trauma as a result of the occupation. Children ingest violence. The occupation gets stuck on the inside. To survive and not be in a state of constant heartbreak, youth learn to confine their aspirations to the already too small spaces allotted. The violences of the occupation become the norm. The walls are naturalized, guns equal power, and waiting and uncertainty is a way of life.
That was Sol Kelly-Jones, then at the age of 23, 2 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty powerful stuff. Very good.
She is. I will send you some links to some other things. And actually, when she returned to this country, she wrote a play about this that appeared locally, and Anyway, I can't say enough there, but I better get back to the interview. So, but there are a couple of common threads here. One of the things I see in both what your parents have written about, what you have written, your sister, other relatives, is to put this, get us to put ourselves in the shoes of the children of Palestine and what effect this has had on them. Could you reflect on that for a bit?
Sure. Look, the process of ethnic cleansing is a cruel process, and it's a process that goes on to this day. And Israel has really perfected this in terms of destroying. You know, there was a discussion about sociocide, how Israel is destroying the Palestinian society. This is true. They're destroying Palestinian society. They're destroying Palestinian culture. They're destroying the structure of day-to-day life, making it so difficult and so painful and so traumatizing. And all this is in an effort to continue the ethnic cleansing. This is not, you know, when people talk about ethnic cleansing, they think it's a process where you put people in trucks and drive them away. And this was a big part of it in the early years, in 1947 and again 1967. But since 1967, the ethnic cleansing has taken different turns. And one of the developments was that Israel developed a very cruel bureaucracy. And that bureaucracy makes life for day-to-day people, for children to go to school, for fathers to make a living, for mothers to do whatever they need to do to take care of their kids and so on, absolutely impossible to do. And absolutely abnormal. There is no sense of normalcy, or if there is, it's very, very small. And traumatizing children and traumatizing children is one of the ways in which Israel punishes the Palestinian adults for not leaving and trying to get them to leave, because what would you not do for your child?
Yeah.
And of course it's painful. I mean, you know, there's a horrific bureaucracy which is dedicated completely and totally and funded in order to make life impossible. So you need permits and you have restrictions. You need more permits. You need more restrictions. And the army at every step of the way makes sure that the Palestinians have to comply. And there's really no recourse for them. They've got nobody to turn to. I mean, from time to time, they turn to the Israeli Supreme Court, but it doesn't do them any good because the entire system in Israel is part of the ethnic cleansing, so they're not going to help. And that's exactly how the ethnic cleansing is taking place. And at the same time, as this is happening, homes are being destroyed, entire cities and towns are being destroyed, entire neighborhoods are being wiped off the face of the earth, and people are becoming homeless again and again and again. And this is happening as we speak, and it's being paid for by American people, by American tax dollars.
Just to bring that point home, if you humor me, I'm going to play just another few seconds from Soul Speech 2 years ago. Track 5, if you could, Lucas.
The wall, along with all the other technologies of occupation, effectively annexes 50% of the land of the West Bank, dividing Palestinian families from neighbors, schools, jobs, medical facilities, farmland, and water sources. Since it's not built on the internationally recognized Green Line, the wall does not really separate Israel from Palestine, but Palestine from Palestine, and demolishes everything in its path, from olive groves and farmlands to masses of people's houses. Walking along the wall, nothing, no intellectual analysis, no prior viewing of photographs, nothing can prepare one for the sight of absolute inhumanity. It's really hideous. One wants to vomit. There is something absolutely debilitating about viewing 20-foot-high concrete slabs that literally strangle a people, the livelihood, and the basic humanity throughout the West Bank. Resistance art is visible along much of the wall, and a small painted logo in the bottom of one of the panels reads, "Made in the USA." Built by U.S. money, the wall, like other architecture of the occupation, is subsidized by our tax dollars. Palestinians understand this. Israelis understand this. The international community understands this. It is time that we come to understand it. It's U.S. policy. Our tax dollars will sustain and expand the occupation and the denial of basic human rights.
And again, that was Solthia Kelly Jones speaking.
Wonderful.
Oh,
well, she's absolutely right. I think Americans are the least informed people in the world about this issue. They're paying for it. Maybe that's why. You know, Americans have no clue about what goes on there, and they have no clue why they think they're giving all this money to some kind of a developing country, like they're helping the Jews with their, you know, build their state.
It's something I wanted to emphasize at the outset, that it was true. I think that discussion is so much harder to have in this country in some ways than it is in the Middle East, in Israel. Does that make sense?
Yes, because Americans are not informed. Americans are the least informed people on this issue. And so because news in America, by and large, the major news outlets in America are entertained. They're a form of entertainment. They see themselves as forms of entertainment. You've got the Fox Entertainment, you've got the MSNBC Entertainment, you've got the CNN, you know, they're all different forms of, but the main thing is entertainment and selling commercials. So you'll have 60 Minutes from time to time, and you'll have good quality, media outlets, but they're usually, smaller, and they don't get that much airtime. But basically, Americans are not informed, and that's why it's so difficult to have this conversation with Americans, because you have to start from very basic. And everybody, and she's right, because everybody else in the world, in Africa and in Asia and the Middle East and in Europe, everybody else knows more than Americans do about this issue.
Yeah.
And it's very, very difficult to have that conversation here. And if you talk to somebody and you try to describe the life of a Palestinian, it is absolutely unbelievable. It's so horrific that who could believe something like this, especially since Israel has this image of being this, like us, like a normal country, a democracy, and so on and so forth. But what she's describing is precisely what is took place in the rest of Palestine after 1948. That's exactly what Israel did with the West Bank, is it made it completely part of it. It completely erased Palestine, basically, and turned the whole thing into Israel.
Yeah. Well, I've had the pleasure of sharing, with the experience of my niece, and I do want to talk about the experience of your niece and how this all relates. I think, again, there's some threads that weave through, as you described very compellingly in your book. I believe was it 1997?
Yeah, on September the 4th, 1997, in a suicide attack in Jerusalem, my niece, she was 13 years old, Smadar Al-Hanan, was killed.
Yeah.
And this was big news for several reasons. First of all, she was the granddaughter of a well-known general, and Israel adores its generals. But on top of that, she was the granddaughter of what they used to call Mr. Peace of Palestine, and now look what they did to him, My father passed away 2 years before that, so he didn't experience this.
And she was killed in a bombing by Palestinian suicide bombers.
Yes, it was a suicide attack, yes.
Yeah.
And when this came, and this was, when this happened, my sister's reaction, my sister's comments, more than anything, I know they put me on a path of which I'm still on today, and she shocked everybody because she shattered one of those myths that everybody believes in, which is it's all the Palestinians' fault and the Palestinians are killers and they're murderers and so on and so forth. And when she was asked, first of all, about retaliation, her comment was, no real mother would want this to happen to any other mother. No real mother would want to see another mother go through this, so don't talk to me about killing other people. And then, so she kind of brought the Palestinians and us and everybody else in the world and reminded us of our common humanity and motherhood being this uniting force. And then the other thing, when she was asked about who she felt was responsible, she said, these two young men killed themselves and took away my daughter and several other innocent civilians, and they were brought to this state of despair and hopelessness precisely by the brutal and horrific occupation and oppression that we, the Israelis, have placed upon them.
Yeah.
And I point my finger, and she said this very clearly, she said, I point my finger at my own government, because this is what happens when you take people's land and homes and water, and you put their fathers in prison, and you shoot their brothers and sisters in school, and you don't allow them to lead any kind of normal life, and you take away any hope and any sense of freedom. This is what happens, and this is the price that we pay.
And ironically,
and interestingly enough, Bibi Netanyahu,
yeah,
who's prime minister today, was prime minister then too.
And he was a schoolmate of hers as well, right?
He was. They were good friends. I mean, he used to come to our house a lot. I mean, there was a friendship there, a real friendship,
And yet that was strained during that week. He called. He was wondering whether to come by to visit. But your sister's husband was especially adamant that was not appropriate.
Yeah, well, the relationship was strained as soon as Bibi became as soon as he got into politics.
Yeah.
It was obvious that he was the friendship could no longer continue. Besides that, usually a prime minister visits, you know, the homes of bereaved after a tragedy.
Yeah.
And she told him, my sister on the phone told him not to come. It would be totally unacceptable that for him to show his face, because we all saw him as responsible.
Your sister and your brother-in-law's full names? I forget.
Rami and Nurit. Nurit is my sister.
Nurit, and her last name?
Nurit Teled El Hanan.
Okay. And I was just going to refer
Rami
folks.
And she, by the way, just published a book on the Israeli education system,
okay,
demonstrating the racism and how racism is applied in the Israeli education system. It's called Palestine in Israeli school books.
I was just going to also refer people back to the comments you were quoting from. I think they were in the Los Angeles Times. Just the amazing insights that she was sharing that shortly after having lost her daughter, and once again attributing this to the Israeli record of oppression and in the occupation. You also describe at the time that this was all happening, your brother-in-law was approached by someone from a group, I think, that was encouraging dialogues between both Palestinian and Israeli people who had lost family members. And at first his reaction was, when he'd heard he'd come during the Shiva, that this was an intrusion, it was inappropriate, he was quite angry at him, and yet the gentleman continued in dialogue with him. You said he was someone who was very accustomed to having this kind of conversation with someone who was in the pain of grief. And eventually that kind of came full circle, didn't it?
Yes, he was approached by Yitzhak Frankenthal, who many people here in this country know, and he was the founder of the Bereaved Families Forum. And to his credit, I have to say, he brought together some very unlikely people and talk about reconciliation and facilitated reconciliation of people that you never would have thought would have ever been able to find reconciliation or peace. And the Bereaved Families Forum is an organization of bereaved families, both Palestinians and Israelis, who get together, first of all, to get to know one another and to share the pain and to reconcile. And then they go on and they speak to others, and their point is, if we can meet one another and we can speak to each other, then certainly the politicians can, and certainly the claim that there is no partner for peace is absurd. And that's been their message. And my brother-in-law Rami who's also been to this country and spoken many places, this is something he's devoted his life to, this organization and to this notion that reconciliation is possible.
Yeah. We're down to our last 7 minutes or so, but there's a couple of other things. I want to take you just a little further on your journey from that development. A parallel path, I think, was back in Coronado, California, a suburb of San Diego where you're living at the time, and you were approaching a similar group, maybe with a little bit of trepidation, and ultimately discovered that it was a group in some ways in which you had more of a commonality with the Palestinians than you did perhaps with some of the Jewish Americans you knew.
Yes, it was when I came back after the funeral, I felt I had to do something. I mean, you can't just go to work the next day and pretend that, because your entire world is shattered. On the other hand, you can't give up everything that you've created. You have your own children and your own life. And so I was very fortunate in that I found a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group. And it was an excellent group of people who met once a month in San Diego, and the purpose of the dialogue was to tell your story, not to accuse and not to argue. And that is how first of all, yes, I felt I had so much in common with the Palestinians because we were all of that country. You know, the American Jews really have no connection to Palestine or Israel, because it's kind of a mythic, kind of a, you know, strange little connection that was put together by politicians. And so we connected right away, and then gracefully and very gracefully and very generously, they opened their hearts to me, and I realized what the Nakba was, and I was hearing stories about mass expulsions and about massacres and so on. And everybody was just telling the story of their particular family, and they were there for the same reason that I was there, which was to learn and to find reconciliation and to find some kind of a way to move forward. It was a healing process, and it was a process that propelled me to investigate more and become active and eventually become the activist that I did become, and so on.
And the other thing I love about that story too is the sharing of the food, the tabbouleh and the hummus, that were common foods that crossed those lines.
True, yeah. I mean, Israelis adopted all the Palestinian foods, and so we assume they're ours. And suddenly you discover that actually somebody's been eating them even before us. There's this funny story about how you know, Israelis, particularly Israelis that come from Eastern Europe, the food is kind of bland and boring, and suddenly we were all exposed to all this wonderful, you know, Palestinian Middle Eastern food. And so we just took it and claimed it as our own. But there was a lot of other things. I mean, there were pictures of Jerusalem. There were in the homes. There was all the sense that there was a connection to the country because they came from there. They came from there, and I came from there. So we talked about the same views. We talked about the same places. We talked about the same scenery and landscape, you know. And it was a very, very strong connection. Like I said, thanks to them, I was you know, when you discover something that's contrary, that's diametrically opposed to what you know to be true about your own country, especially when your own country, as in my case, your own country is like your own family. I mean, it's you know, I grew up in a family that was very patriotic, and Israel was everything.
Yeah.
And suddenly you learn that all the heroism and all the mythology is nothing but mythology, and very little of it is true. It's painful beyond words. And many Jews and other Israelis would come to these meetings and leave, you know, very angry that how could these Palestinians say these things? You know, I couldn't discount them because I came to trust them, and that's really what happens. Trust replaces fear, and that's how you move forward. And eventually I learned more, and I studied more, and I read Ilan Pappa's books, and became familiar with him, and so on and so forth. And that's how I ended up understanding and getting a good concept of what actually, you know, the nature of the relations between Israelis and Palestinians, and between Israel and the Palestinians.
We're running out of time, but I did also want to get your reflections on your trips actually into Palestine. But before I do that, just make sure folks know about this. Again, October 25th, our guest Miko Peled will be speaking at the Pyle Center at 702 Langdon Street on the UW-Madison campus. So you also just, you know, I think we're very honest about, I think it was maybe a time after all this was happening, traveling into the West Bank, going through the border in a car with clearly marked Israeli license plates, at times needing to ask directions, you know, wondering if, you know, what were you going to encounter? Yeah.
If this was my last day on Earth. You know, the fear is a very strong thing, and when it's embedded in you at a very young age, it stays, and it comes up at the, you know, if somebody would have asked me if I was afraid of Arabs, of Palestinians, I'd say, are you crazy? I'm not afraid. Why would I be afraid? And then as I was driving alone for the very first time on my own in a car, driving myself into the West Bank, and Israeli cars have different license plates than Palestinian cars, I suddenly remembered that as a kid, when we would travel to the West Bank, my dad always had his AK-47 in the car.
Mm-hmm.
And all the stories about massacres, that, you know, how Arabs killed Jews, and all these different stories, and this mythology, this thing just came up and started flooding me. And I had to just calm myself down and say, okay, it's going to be all right, it's going to be okay. And instead of really enjoying this gorgeous scenery that the West Bank offers, and there weren't that many settlements then, today a lot of it is built, you know, I was sure that there was somebody ready to kill me around the corner. And the reason Israel is so successful is because it managed to create such a terrible sense of fear on one side, my side, the Israeli side, and a sense of frustration and anger on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how you keep people apart.
Well, you know, what struck me from folks that have gone over, and of course Americans potentially could face some hostility there, and yet it's this innate sense of hospitality that really pervades Palestinian society that they encounter.
Yeah, I still haven't found the Palestinian that's waiting to kill me.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, just very briefly, but elections were held today, I guess, in the West Bank. What future do you see for, what is the future you would desire for a Palestinian state?
Well, there's not going to be a Palestinian state.
Okay.
I couldn't be more sure of that than anything. I mean, there will never be a Palestinian state. Israel will never permit the Palestinians to create a state. Israel will continue to destroy Palestinian homes and towns and villages and monuments if it's permitted to do so for the next 100 years until they can establish this absurd connection between today's Zionist Israel and you know, the glorious past of King David, who may or may not have ever existed.
Can Americans do something to counter that?
I'm sorry?
Can Americans do something to help counter that?
Americans, as a people, can. They can demand that America stop supporting it because it's a racist state that's conducting a cruel ethnic cleansing of an innocent people who have never had a military force. So Americans can do a lot. I don't think the American administration will do anything, but American people can certainly sway the administration.